Okay, everyone, so let us continue roughly where we left off yesterday. So we are now looking at Right Effort on the Noble Eightfold Path, factor number 6. And this next couple of suttas, they're also kind of roughly in that area about right effort, how to think rightly, how to reflect rightly so as to overcome defilements and in a sense, make the mind ready for meditation practice proper, which is Satipatthana, which is a 7th factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So now we're going to have a look at the contemplation of death in particular. And contemplation of death is very, I think, very important and very interesting on the spiritual path. And we've already seen how the Buddha to be, how he used that as he started out, you know, his basically his monastic life or his going forth began in very much with contemplation of illness, old age and death. It's a very important part. Yeah, the very beginning of Buddhahood, in a sense, started with that. So why is it that this was so powerful for the Buddha? How can we use it to empower our own spiritual life as well in a similar kind of way? Yeah, it's almost hard to understand, isn't it, how those simple thoughts can actually drive someone to, you know, to find awakening the way it happened with the Buddha. So how can we tap into the same ideas to kind of improve and kind of encourage our own spiritual life? This is what this is about, really. These are very important things, and I will talk about it later on. Maybe talk about it briefly now, why they are so important or how they are talked about by the Buddha in the suttas. The recollection of death, for example, is talked about in many, many different places. This is how you decide whether something really is important in the Dhamma or not. How often is it talked about, the different occasions and all of these kind of things. This is a very common contemplation, and for that reason it is very important. The Buddha specifically says that death contemplation, not just death contemplation, old age, sickness, all of these things, they are contemplation that should be done by everyone. Yeah, it is sometimes you get the feeling that there's maybe a slight difference in teaching between monastics and lay people, although that is just in appearance. It really depends on the situation. But this is specifically said, everybody should do it. So it has this very basic, kind of profound, foundational principle that kind of carries everyone along in the right way. So it is an important part of right view as well, and all the rest of it. So anyway, let's have a look at what the Buddha has to say. So first of all, here we have the simile of the mountain. And at Savati, then in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One. And the Blessed One said to him as he was sitting to one side, "Now where are you coming from, great king, in the middle of the day?" So here we have King Pasenadi, the king of this large country called Kosala, one of the largest countries in India, north of India at that time. It actually is quite a large country, as I think I mentioned before. And coming in the middle of the day, yeah? Why is that in there? And that just means that it's coming at an unusual time. Usually when you go to visit the Buddha, it's usually in the evening. You go to hear a Dhamma talk. You don't come just in the middle of the day like that. It's kind of slightly kind of inappropriate, perhaps. So obviously there was an important reason, and that's why that is in there. So, where are you coming from? "Just now, venerable sir, I have been engaged in those affairs of kingship, typical for head-anointed Khatiya kings, who are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained stable control in their country, and who have, having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth." So here you have this king who says, "I've been engaged in all those affairs, who are typical for, kings who are intoxicated by power, etc., by greed for sensual pleasures." It's kind of nice, it's very honest about kind of the, what it's like to be a king. Yeah, it's kind of good. So, and just to briefly, Khatiya kings. Khatiya doesn't mean Kshatriya. This is one of the four castes in ancient India. Kshatriyas are like the administrative or the ruling caste, if you like. The kings were very often Kshatriya caste, almost always, in fact. So he's like the top of the social hierarchy, obviously, but for many reasons. And then he says these things, we are intoxicated. And this is kind of one of the things about life in general, that there are so many areas in which we are potentially intoxicated by things. Power being an obvious one that he's talking about here. Sensual pleasures, we talked about that before. And one of the things that you will see now is that not only in these areas, but the very fact that you forget about that you're going to die, forget about old age, illness. These things are also intoxicating. Yeah, I'm alive. I can do whatever I want. I'm young, healthy. Yeah, this is the time to enjoy myself. You know, not worry about the consequences. We sort out the consequences later on. Now is the time to enjoy myself. Now the opportunity is there. That's called intoxication. You forget about the big picture of things. You're focused on kind of the immediate gratification and pleasures. And that becomes really problematic. So this is why in Buddhism so much is about clarifying the mind, making the mind clear, so you have a better grasp of what actually matters in life, what is truly important. Otherwise, we get us pulled along by all of these intoxications, by sensuality, by all the world. The whole world is intoxicated by these things. So we tend to get dragged on in the slipstream of the rest of the world without being able to think for ourselves. This is why it's so important to sometimes step back a little bit, go on a retreat, listen to somebody who's really wise, yeah, like the Buddha, and then being able to get a different approach, a different view. Otherwise, we just follow along. We become one more sheep in the kind of large, you know, large group of sheep in the world. So being a bit different, doing things differently, actually usually is a sign of, not always, but it can be a sign that you are, you know, you're taking a bit more responsibility for yourself, not kind of just following along automatically like everyone else. So this is kind of the first point. Remember, it's so easy to get that slight intoxication, yeah? Whereby you lose your clarity, lose your ability to see what matters. And your priorities suffer as a consequence as well. So he gets it, yeah, he understands. This is kind of to the king's credit that he understands that there is a problem there. So what does the Buddha reply? This is what he says. What do you think, great king? Here a man would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached you, he would tell you, for sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. Then a second man would come to you from the west, a third man would come to you from the north, and a fourth man would come to you from the south, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached you, he would tell you, for sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the south, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. If, great king, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done? And this is one of these, I think, really great similes, at least it was for me when I read this. I thought it's really driving home the point that is so important. And of course the point here is that if you have a mountain coming from all directions, the point is that there is no escape. There is no way getting out of this. This is a guarantee that eventually you will be crushed by this mountain. This is kind of the point here, yeah? There is no way of getting out of this. And then the question, of course, well, if that is the case, okay, instead of getting upset, instead of getting kind of sad, and instead of kind of despairing because life is this way, you sit back and you think, now, well, what does this mean for me? This is the reality. Let's be clear-eyed about this. Let's not hide our head in the sand. But let's see reality as it actually is. What are the consequences of this mess we are in, this problem that we're in? And this is what he's asking here, the king, well, what is the consequences of this? Yeah, this is the right way. You're sitting here. There's a massive mountain coming from all directions. You know the end is nigh, as they say, yeah? You know this is it. What are the consequences of that? This is kind of to undo the intoxication, to make you think clearly about things. And one of the little points here towards the bottom here is that this is a very, also a very Buddhist way of looking at things, is this idea of the human state being so difficult to obtain. A very kind of Buddhist outlook, and of course it implies the idea of rebirth, of re-existence, and all of this. And this outlook is basically the idea that, in this kind of sequence of births and rebirths, becoming a human being is actually a very auspicious and very positive thing, because you have a degree of clarity, you have you have the right conditions to maybe to be able to, to find a solution to the problems. So now is the opportunity, now is the chance, and you don't know when the chance comes back again in the future. Such an important thing to remember that. This is a very kind of Buddhist way of looking at things. So what does the king reply to this? His mind clears up. What does it mean? If, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? And the Buddha replies, I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, old age and death are rolling in on you. When old age and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done? As old age and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? So it is, great king, so it is, great king. As old age and death are rolling in on you, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? Old age and death crush you. You have no choice. There is no escape. There are these massive mountains moving in from all directions. It's approaching every day. The mountain is coming nearer. Every day you can see it on the horizon almost, coming towards you. And you know, if you look at it in the right way, you know that there is no way to escape this. And it changes your attitude. You start to look at life in a different way here. And this is the purpose of this little sutta. Okay, so that's just setting the scene. And now we come to the real, the sutta on how to contemplate old age, etc. And this is a sutta that I very often read out on these retreats. And this is, again, is the time of the Buddha, before he became the Buddha to be, and how he thought about life as he was living, in the luxury, in the home life, and what motivated him, if you like, to go forth, etc. This is what he has to say. I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's house, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed, in another one, red lotuses, in a third one, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi, and my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, so that cold and heat, dust, grass, dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rainy season. And I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion, being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and I did not leave that mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence, they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. So that kind of sets the stage, for what comes afterwards. And of course, the purpose of this is to show that the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, he lived a life of luxury, what was considered luxury in those days. He had everything in life. He was someone who was lacking in nothing. And this kind of sets the stage, right? Because again, the idea is that if you the point here is that even if you have everything, yeah, even if you have absolutely everything in worldly terms, the Dhamma goes beyond that. The Dhamma, it doesn't matter what you have, because the basic problems of life are still the same, regardless of your social standing, your material standing. The basic problems of reality are exactly the same. So here we show someone starting off with the best possible position in life, and still he reflects in this way. And one of the interesting things here is that about the Buddha's kind of upbringing is that it's not quite the way it is described in later literature. Yeah, this is kind of a small point, but I think an important one to show you why the early suttas actually matter quite a lot. In later literature, it is explained how his father was a king, how he grew up in very grand circumstances, and everything was kind of, whoa, it was really over the top. But here, it is good, it is nice, but it is not kind of absolutely, you know, out of the ordinary. It's not something really, really astonishing. It is good, but kind of not that amazing. So he had kind of, his clothes were from the kind of best kind of cloth. Kasi cloth was the best cloth. Kasi cloth is Benares cloth. Yeah, still go to Benares in the present day, still you get Benares cloth is considered very good. So he had the best cloth. He had kind of someone holding a canopy over him. Okay, that, I guess that's quite luxurious. He had all these lotus ponds. I don't know about that. I mentioned those before. So I guess that's a kind of luxury. And then he had three mansions. It says mansions here, but that sounds very nice. Until you realize that actually it's a bad translation. It does not mean mansion. The Pali word pasado, pasada means just like a stilt house. It doesn't necessarily mean any particular size. So he had three houses, and maybe also they were quite humble in many ways. They were not really mansions. So this is where you have to be careful. And I think what happens when you translate these things is that because you already have a view of the Buddha to be growing up in massive luxury, because that is kind of the traditional way we are taught about the Buddha to be, you already have that view, it's very easy to actually mistranslate these things and not actually look at what these things mean in context in the suttas. So it doesn't actually mean mansion at all. It's really a mistranslation. Of course, that's how the commentaries explain it. And that's why you tend to go wrong when you translate these things. I have to take partial responsibility for this, because I was working with Bhikkhu Bodhi a little bit on this translation, and I should have pointed it out to him. Wait a minute, why are you putting it that way? So we all have our blind spots. So it's not really being overly critical of anyone in particular, is just the way things tend to go. And then the last point here is kind of the nice point. Yeah, the last point where he says that in my father's residence, the workers were looked after. Yeah, they got proper food. They were kind of, proper food specifically is mentioned here. And of course the idea is that it wasn't just a wealthy household, it was a whole household of kindness and compassion as well. And this is kind of the last important point, I suppose, there. So in other words, I had everything. Yeah, when he grew up, there was nothing really lacking. And that is kind of all those things coming together. So that sets the scene. And then, despite that, in spite of all of this, this is what happens. Amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is old, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to old age, am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. So here he is just making the point that this is part of us. Yeah, this is all kind of part of who we are. Old age, if you are young, it is bound to come. Youth and old age are two sides of the same thing. The word youth only has meaning if you also have young old age. Old age only has meaning in terms of youth. These words are like pairs which are mute, always have to come together. So he's just kind of reminding us. So what is it like? How do you feel when you see someone who is really, really old? Yeah, they can't look after themselves. Everything is falling apart. You have to kind of help them to clean up and all of these things. It can be quite humiliating when you are really, really old, coming towards the very last stages of your life. You have to be really prepared to face those situations when everyone else is looking after you. You can't look after yourself anymore. How do you feel about that? Are you okay with that? Or do you feel slight aversion towards that idea? I think most people feel a bit of aversion towards that because you feel you no longer have your independence and kind of everything is like, you know, everything is just getting quite difficult and terrible. It's quite a humiliating situation in some ways unless you are prepared for it. And so this is what this is about. And it's so important to remember that these things are already there. They're already inside of us. They're already part of us. Yeah, old age is in here. I'm actually not that young anymore anyway, but I'm not that ancient either. So it's in here, waiting to come out. Yeah, it is part of me already, part of each one of us. And once you get that this is already inside of you, waiting to come out, then of course it is almost in many ways as if you are already old in a sense, because you cannot avoid that destiny unless you die young, of course, but that's not no real kind of alternative. So it's already there. And once you realize it's inside of you, just waiting to come out, in the same way youth is inside of you, if you're old, waiting to come out because of rebirth and all these things. All of these things are already part of us. And so very useful in that. And when you remember that, it takes away some of the addiction to being young, the idea that I am young, yeah, they are old, but I am young. We are different. We're not different. We are basically there. We are all the same in a very deep sense. So when you think like that, it kind of it takes away some of that illusion in your mind. So old age, sometimes for this reason, it can be very useful to visit people who are old, to see them and to talk to them and to kind of get a feeling for that and to see yourself almost in their position, knowing that one day you will be there yourself. And of course, then it is very useful to have created a mind for yourself that is kind of slightly free of that. The mind can, of course, always, the mind doesn't really get old in the same way. It's just the body that gets old in that way. Again, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to illness, not exempt from illness, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is ill, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to illness, and I am not exempt from illness. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is ill, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with health was completely abandoned. And this, of course, very basic, very obvious truth of reality. If you have a physical body, you're going to get sick. You're going to get colds every now and again. You're going to be coughing and spluttering every now and again. We had a few people coughing during this, including myself. So this is just the nature of things. And yet, and this is kind of the interesting thing, is we take it that something has gone wrong when we get sick. Yeah, that old Ajahn Brahm joke about when you go to the doctor, you should never say, "Doctor, something has gone wrong with me." You should always say, "Oh, doctor, something is right with me again. I'm sick today." And the doctor sends you off to the mental hospital. And that is true, isn't it? There's nothing wrong. This is the nature of the physical body. We are in denial of the nature of the physical body. That is the problem. We are intoxicated with health. We think that is how things should be. But actually, things shouldn't be like that. Things are exactly right. This is life. This is the nature of existence. Health and illness must always go together. Otherwise, the word health has no meaning if there wasn't for the fact of illness. So this is true. This is reality, yeah. And it unblocks that intoxication, idea that something has gone wrong. And there's so much in life which is like that. So many things in life, impermanence, that are just this is the nature of existence. And once you kind of get that, it sort of changes some of your delusions about reality. And now we come to the last one. And the last one of these three is by far the most important one. And this is the one the Buddha talks about again and again in the suttas. And this is the death contemplation here. Again, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself or themselves subject to death, not exempt from death, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when they see another who has died, overlooking their own situation. Now, I too am subject to death, and not exempt from death. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who has died, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with life was completely abandoned. So this is the most powerful one, because it kind of combines old age and illness, almost everything into one in a sense. And it is also the situation where you really, where kind of you are really faced with the reality in a much more profound sense. So of these three, if there's one reflection you should do, it is the last one. You can do all three, of course, but the last one is the most powerful one. And it is found in the suttas under many different names. It's called the Maranasati, which means the recollection of death. It's called Maranasanya, perception of death. And it is described in various ways. And one of the important ways that it is described in the suttas is that you should, is to make it real in the present moment. Yeah? The idea of death, there's many ways you can think, yeah, I'm going to die down the line. Yeah? But that is not really Maranasati. It's kind of, it's too casual, it's not really getting to grips what really is going on. So the idea is to bring it as close to the present moment as possible. Yeah, and of course the idea here is that if you are going to be ready to die, there's only one time you can be ready to die, and that is now. You cannot say, I will be ready when death eventually comes. And the reason you can't do that is because you never know when it's going to come. It comes very often at unexpected times. Almost nobody is ready when they are dying. Almost everyone thinks, oh, it's going to be a few more years down the track or a few more months. Even when you're kind of 85 or 90 or 95 and you get a serious illness, you think, oh, yeah, I'll recover and then I'll carry on afterwards. But it's just illusion, yeah? And it's, you're never really ready. And then suddenly it comes and it's happened. So there's only one time to be ready, and that is now. So you have to be ready now. Are you able to kind of make death a reality in the present moment? Yeah, and to do that, you have to remember how uncertain life actually is, how unreliable it is. You never really know what's going to happen next. One of the great things about being a monk is seeing people die at all ages. And remember, when someone else dies at a young age, we tend to think, yeah, they were just foolish, they behaved in the wrong way. Actually, it's not like that. This could be you. You could be in exactly the same situation. Nobody really chooses to die. It just happens because of cause and conditions. So remember that. This could be you. And because it could be you, things can happen. Now is the time to be ready. So sometimes it can be helpful just to think about the various ways you could die. Yeah, you could have a heart attack, bang, be gone just like that. You could have some cancer working in your body at this moment. You don't know about it. Yeah. Somewhere in here, kind of, is there cancer in here? Probably is, yeah. Probably is a cancer in here somewhere, because they're always kind of there, you know. Some of these bad cells are already there, just waiting for the right kind of opportunity to start multiplying massively, and then bang, yeah, you have cancer everywhere. Yeah, it's real. When some of your family members get cancer like that, you kind of start to think about yourself. Yeah, maybe the same thing is happening for me. Or whatever it is, you know, sometimes you just walk through the forest and you stumble somewhere, you fall over, you fall in the wrong way, and that's it. You go get into the traffic in the city, and somebody hits you with a car, and that's it, you're dead. These things happen all the time. So make it real. You just have no idea. Now is the opportunity. There is no other opportunity to make it real. So now you have to be ready. If you are ready now, then there is a chance you will also be ready when it actually happens. So what does it feel like if I'm going to be dead in a week? If I'm going to be dead tomorrow? If I were dead in an hour? Yeah. If I was to die on my next breath? What does it feel like are you ready to die on your next breath? It's kind of really getting close to home when you talk about the next breath. Yeah, it's like you have seconds basically left of your life. So that is the idea. And when you do that, and if you're able to do that to some extent, just go slowly. Don't kind of go too fast. Bring it home in a kind of slow way so you're able to deal with this perception. It doesn't become scary and something that kind of frightens you off. So do what feels comfortable for you. And what happens when you do that is that you start to let go a little bit in this life. And what you let go of, the most important things we let go of when we do this, is the things like the basic defilements of the mind, like greed and ill will. Because greed and ill will is almost completely related to the world we live in right here. But if you are about to leave this world, if you know that you're kind of, you know, you're out of here, and it could happen at any time, then all that greed and all that ill will that you have that relate to this world, they become sillier. Yeah, you're not going to think about the kind of the next thing you're going to have or the next relationship or anything like that. Or even the next meal you're not going to be concerned about. Why? Because you're dying. You're on your deathbed, like that death contemplation, just waiting to die. Everything in this world starts to become irrelevant. So that this is the beautiful thing about death contemplation, is that when you do that, the intoxication disappears. You abandon the defilements, if it really works well. Or at least they become much, much less. And then that can then be used as a contemplation to help you in your meditation practice. This is what this is about. Yeah, this is the purpose of this kind of contemplation. It is not always easy, because our habits, again, are very counter to this idea of drawing death into our life, so to speak. It kind of goes very counter to our habits and our ways of thinking. But once you kind of get around that, actually it is very powerful and very beautiful. It makes you peaceful. It makes you relaxed. It makes you let go of things in this world. And that is a very useful tool, of course, to have in your meditation practice. So this is the kind of the standard way of doing this, especially when you go on retreat and you have a bit of extra time, or even at home, yeah, you can do this kind of contemplation a little bit. And in daily life, it is very useful to remind ourselves also of the uncertainty of life, because it changes the way we deal with people. And I remember there was this man I met a few years ago, and he told me that every day when he leaves his house in the morning to go to work or whatever, he said that he reminded himself that he could die today. It meant that when he left his house, he made sure he did so in a good way. Yeah, he said goodbye to his wife and to his kids in a positive way, so that he kind of felt ready that, okay, I'm ready to die today. I haven't got any kind of unfinished stuff or any kind of last minute arguments that kind of is going to be difficult to deal with when you die. So you use the idea of death in a positive way to encourage your kindness, to encourage the way to deal with people in the right way. And this, in this way, it becomes a very useful thing in your life, a force for good, if you like, reminding you of how to live in the right way. So this is the idea of the death contemplation. To kind of clear your mind up, to set you up for meditation practice, and in this way to encourage your path forward. So that is what it really is about. I'm not going to spend too much more time on that, because we have still quite a lot of suttas left, and we don't have that much time left, so I'm going to just go a little bit faster than usual with some of these suttas. But if you like me to add more to this, please do so in the question time this evening, and we can talk about this a bit more then, if you like. Anyway, then the Buddha says, there are these three kinds of intoxication. What three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, and intoxication with life. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with youth, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. With the break of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination in the lower world. The uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with health, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. And with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination in the lower world, in hell. an uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with life, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind, and with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. So this is the consequences of not thinking about these things. The consequences of being intoxicated, if you like, is that you start doing silly things. And that then, of course, has very bad consequences for you. And then the very last one here, which is quite nice and interesting here. Intoxicated with youth, a monastic gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Or intoxicated with health, they give up the training and revert to the lower life. Or intoxicated with life, they give up the training and revert to the lower life. So the death contemplation actually keeps you in the robes because you realize that you're not returning to anything at all, quite possibly. Yeah, you're not kind of going anywhere, and you are in the right place. You remind yourself of what actually is significant in life, what really matters. And this way, you actually stay on in the monastic robes as a consequence. So there you are. That is the, in brief, the death contemplation and what it can do for you if you carry it out in the right way here. So please don't get depressed about this. Yeah, death is good when you think about it in the right way. It is useful. It is the reality anyway. So we have to deal with it one way or another. Anyway, now we have looked at right effort. How to kind of start to purify our minds in various ways by thinking about the world in the correct way, by setting up the right kind of perceptions, by trying to see the positive in other people, by forgiving them for their foibles because we see that they are kind of just creating suffering for themselves, how to understand sensual pleasures in context, and also now the death contemplation as well. So these are the right efforts. And as you practice those right efforts, gradually you abandon some of the coarser aspects of the mind, the coarser defilements, and your mind gradually clears up. You get more mindfulness coming because the defilements are what drives the mind out of the present moment, yeah, to the future, to the past, and all of these kind of things. Gradually you get more clarity. And as the clarity emerges, mindfulness starts to arise more and more powerfully. And then there comes a point when you are basically ready to do the meditation practice. And that is where we get the transition from the right effort to right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is really a bad meditation practice and taking us towards samadhi down the track. So now I want to have a look at the meditation practice itself, how it actually works. Seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma Sati, and this of course is all about Satipatthana practice. So we're now going to read out how Satipatthana practice is done. This is the brief analysis here of Satipatthana as it is found in the suttas. And what is right mindfulness? Here one dwells contemplating the body in the body. Ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating feelings in feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating mind in mind, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is called right mindfulness. Yeah, so that is how you do Satipatthana practice in brief. I am not sure if it is very clear to you from that what you're supposed to do. But to me, it is not necessarily very clear. So I'll try to draw out the meaning here a little bit so you can see what's going on. So the first one here, contemplating the body in the body, kaya kaya nupasi. Contemplating, anupassi means to look along, so it means like to observe, yeah? Either you observe the body or you contemplate it in terms of thinking about it. Either way is acceptable. Yeah, it is just different ways of dealing with it. Usually it is more of an imagination exercise, but sometimes with the breath it is a direct observation exercise. So it is both in a sense. And the body in the body What this means is that you contemplate a particular attribute or aspect of the body. One aspect, yeah? One attribute, one way of looking at the body. There are different ways. This means like one set of phenomena among many bodily phenomena. The word kaya means a group of things, so a certain group among groups. In other words, for example, the breath. The breath is a set of various, the set of all breaths is the group of breaths. Or the four elements is a particular way of looking at the body. So it means a particular aspect, particular way of looking at the body is what that refers to in my understanding of this. And you are ardent. Ardent is atapi. It means like you have like a energy, you do it with energy and with some degree of effort. Yeah, the word ardent is not a very common word in the English language, so it's not kind of all that clear, but it's the idea of having energy. It is a word that is related to the Pali words virya for energy and also for padana, which is about applying yourself. Clearly comprehending, this is sampajano. Yeah, what does that mean? And what it means is that while we do our meditation practice, we have clarity about whether we are doing what we're supposed to do or not. That's really what it comes down to. So when you are watching the breath, yeah, are you try to be clear, am I actually watching the breath or am I fantasizing about something? Am I watching the breath in the kind of right way, or am I in my mindfulness properly established or not? So you have an idea whether you are doing what you're supposed to be doing, rather than drifting off and getting the wrong way. So clear comprehension is always about this idea of, am I moving towards the goal? Am I doing what is the purpose of the practice is, or am I not? Yeah, and that takes quite a bit of mindfulness, of course. And because it takes mindfulness, the next factor here is mindful. And this is interesting, and this is important, that the word mindful is actually used right there in the Satipatthana practice. It means that to be able to do Satipatthana, you have to be mindful first. This is how you practice Satipatthana. You are already mindful. And this is sometimes problematic. You know, you have translations sometimes into English. Satipatthana is translated as the foundation of mindfulness or foundation for mindfulness. And a translation like that gives the idea that you are practicing Satipatthana to get mindfulness. Yeah, it is a foundation of mindfulness. It means you do this so that you become mindful. But that is actually not really quite right. You have to have mindfulness established first. Then you can do Satipatthana practice. Mindful here is like an adjective which qualifies the way we do Satipatthana. Yeah, Satipatthana is done through mindfulness. And of course, the reason for that is because if you are going to be able to watch the breath, you have to have mindfulness first. If you're not mindful first, you're going to be all over the place. There's nothing, you can't really watch the breath properly. So mindfulness has to be established first. And this is why right effort goes first. That abandons the gross defilements that hinder you from becoming mindful, and then mindfulness arises based on that. It's quite logical. The sequence here is actually makes very good sense psychologically once you think about it. So mindfulness comes first. Then you have this last little phrase here, which is very important: having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. And covetousness and displeasure, these words in Pali, abhijja domanassa. And here, the meaning of these two words is basically desire, yeah, desire and aversion in regard to the world. That's really what it means. Displeasure is okay. Covetousness, I think, really misses the point. Covetousness means like you want other people's property, but it's not just that. It's a general desire for the objects of the five or six senses. That's what it actually is referring to. So having removed that, having largely removed your interest or disinterest in worldly phenomena, the aversion and the desire, attraction to things in the world. In the world here refers to the world of the five senses. That's what it refers to. Sometimes the world is used in that particular way in the suttas. Yeah, and that is exactly the same expression that you find in the previous path factor, of five of the right effort. It actually specifically says that you avoid, the purpose of that factor is to avoid desire and aversion in regard to the worldly phenomena. It's exactly what it says in that factor. So that factor avoids that, or you abandon that, and then come into the next factor, they have been abandoned. Yeah, you can see how there's a logical sequence there. Even the vocabulary ties in with each other. Huh? One thing leading to the next one. Huh? So that is what it means. So what does this mean in practice? And what it means in practice is that it does not necessarily mean, as I understand it, that you have abandoned all defilements of the mind before you can do satipatthana, because the purpose of satipatthana is quite clear, in my opinion, from many suttas, is to actually help you abandon the very last remnant of defilements. What it means is that you have abandoned enough defilements that your mind is essentially, you are in the present moment. You have a degree of clarity about what is going on. Yeah, that is really what it is about, the kind of the mindfulness that we try to give rise to in meditation. It doesn't mean your mind is absolutely pure, because that comes a little bit further down as you enter samadhi in particular. So that is the idea behind this, yeah? And you can see here how basically what it is about, what it tells you is that you have purified your mind to a large extent to the point where you are able to be mindful and do the meditation. That's really what it comes down to. And the meditation here is divided into four areas. Yeah, the first one is bodily phenomena, which means, like, you know, one way of doing that is just to watch the breath. In fact, that, I think, is the main practice of satipatthana, is actually breath meditation. And we'll see that later on when we come to the Anapanasati Sutta, which is all about breath meditation. But you can also contemplate the body in different ways. You can do the element meditation, whereby you divide your body up into elements. Yeah, you have the kind of the solid element, you have the watery element, the air, yeah, the breathing, that kind of thing. And you can see your body in terms of elements. And the purpose of that meditation is just to remind yourself that this physical body is no different from the elements outside. Yeah, that takes away some of the attachment to the body if you do that. And you can do 31 parts of the body if you're really keen on body contemplation. But I usually recommend people just to watch the breath. That's usually kind of the easiest way, the most kind of natural way, and the most important way as well in the suttas to do body contemplation. Then you have contemplation of feelings. How do we do that? Again, later on we'll see all you have to do is to watch the feelings that arise as you watch the breath. That is sufficient to fulfill the feeling contemplation. Feelings just means that you contemplate certain feelings among the whole spectrum of possible feelings. Mind in mind really means certain mind qualities among other mind qualities. Yeah, this too can be done through mindfulness of breath. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Mindfulness of breathing is everywhere. Yeah. It kind of fulfills everything. Yeah. Don't have to worry about anything else. It's kind of makes it very simple. Yeah. And the last one here, phenomena, this actually refers to things such as understanding the causality of things like defilements and awakening factors. Yeah, the seven bhujangas. So you understand what the defilements in your mind are. You understand how they arise and how they are abandoned. What is meant here by phenomena. Dhamma is the Pali word. And it has specifically to do with causality. How these things come about. What are the causes? Why does desire arise in the mind? Why does ill will? It's actually quite obvious why these things arise, but it's good to see it in yourself, because then it becomes very clear what is happening here. So that is the satipatthana in brief. And the whole thing can be done simply by mindfulness of breathing, and we'll have a look at that sutta probably tomorrow morning. And then we can see how this is done in practice a bit more. I want to have a look at look at these things in a bit more detail. But before I go on to that, I'll just have a look at some of these couple of nice similes here, which kind of brings out a little bit the idea of meditation practice. Now we are dealing with meditation, and this is one of those great little similes in the suttas that kind of draw out some important principles of meditation. Suppose a king had a frontier city with strong ramparts, walls, and arches, and with six gates. The gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent, and intelligent, one who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. A swift pair of messengers would come from the east and ask the gatekeeper, "Where, good man, is the lord of the city?" He would reply, "He is sitting in the central square." Then the swift pair of messengers would deliver a message of reality to the lord of the city and leave by the route by which they had arrived. Similarly, messengers would come from the west, from the north, from the south, deliver the message and leave by the route by which they had arrived. I have made up this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning here. The city, this is a designation for this body consisting of the four elements originating from mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and gruel, subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to breaking apart and dispersal. The six gates, this is a designation for the six internal sense spaces. In other words, eye, ear, etc. The gatekeeper, this is a designation for mindfulness. The swift pair of messengers, this is a designation for serenity and insight, for samatha and vipassana. Yeah? The lord of the city is a designation for consciousness. The central square, this is a designation for the four great elements, the earth, water, heat, and air element. The message of a reality is a designation for extinguishment, nibbana. The route by which they had arrived, this is a designation for the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, right view all the way up to right stillness. So the beauty of this simile, or the idea behind this simile, is to show us a little bit how the meditation works, how insight arises. Yeah, this is kind of the purpose of this. And the first thing to notice here, I would say, is the idea of the gatekeeper. Yeah, this is one of the purposes of mindfulness, is to be a gatekeeper, and that gatekeeper must be wise, competent, and intelligent. One who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. And of course, the point, the strangers here, kind of the bad guys, these are the things that give rise to desire and ill will and all of these kind of things. So you keep out those objects of the world. Yeah, you say no to those that are going to give rise to defilements in your mind. So the kind of the wise gatekeeper, that's your mindfulness. Yeah, who knows how to attend to things in the right way. And you let in the friends. The friends are, in this case, they are samatha and vipassana. Yeah, anything which is kind of enhances your ability to practice the path, those are your friends. Yeah, so that is already quite an important thing, the idea of the gatekeeper who is wise. You have to have mindfulness and you have to have wisdom to know how to be an intelligent and wise gatekeeper. Yeah? And then you have this swift pair of messengers. Yeah, and this is samatha and vipassana. It is calm and clear seeing. Clear seeing, I think, is preferable to insight. So calm and clear seeing. And these messengers, they come by a certain route. And the route they come by is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so this, what this shows you is that when you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, samatha and vipassana come into existence as part of that path. It doesn't mean the path is either samatha or vipassana. This is what I was saying before, that you don't really divide meditation in this way. It just is meditation. Meditation is part of the path. And as a consequence of that, you get the arising of samatha and vipassana. Yeah? They come with the path. You practice the path. Then they come as a consequence of that. Yeah, and then when they come, so this is the point again, that these things are not really divisible. And they arise as a consequence of the practice of the path. They are not the path itself. Kind of here, that distinction is sort of made. And then when you are ready, yeah, when you are come to a deep state of samadhi or whatever, when you are ready, then samatha and vipassana, they are the ones that deliver the message. And that message always comes when those, both of those are together, yeah? together. You need a pair of messengers to deliver the message of reality. You cannot have one or the other. You can't just have vipassana or samatha. You cannot just have samatha without vipassana. They have to come together. When they come together, that is when they deliver the message of reality. And that message of reality is that is the real insight. That is the real wisdom. That is the real extinguishment. The reality of Nibbana itself, where things are extinguished and you find the highest peace, etc., and all of these kind of things. So this gives you an idea of how the path works, yeah? And how you how meditation actually works. And it's a nice simile because it's quite kind of draws out these things quite nicely. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to spend more time on that one. I'm going to have a very quick look at the next sutta before we call it a morning. This is the next one, is the Greater Discourse on Voidness, Mahasunyata Sutta, and I just want to make a couple of points based on this particular sutta. Thus, have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatu in the Grodas Park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Kapilavatu for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kapilavatu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal he went for his daytime abiding to the dwelling of Kalakemaka, the Sakyan. Now, on that occasion, there were many resting places prepared at Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwelling. When the Blessed One saw this, he thought, there are many resting places prepared here. Do many monks live here? Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Ananda, along with many monks, was busy making robes at Gata, the Sakyan's dwelling. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from retreat and went to Gata, the Sakyan's dwelling. There he sat down on the seat, made ready, and asked the Venerable Ananda, Ananda, there are many resting places prepared in Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwelling. Do many monks live there? Venerable Sir, many resting places are prepared there. Many monks are living there. This is our time for making robes, Venerable Sir. And then the Buddha replies, he says, Ananda, one does not shine by delighting in company, by taking delight in company, by devoting oneself to delight in company, by delighting in society, by taking delight in society, by rejoicing in society. Indeed, Ananda, it is not possible that one who delights in company, takes delight in company, has devoted himself to delight in company, who delights likewise in society, will ever obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of awakening. But it can be expected that when you live alone, withdrawn from society, you will obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, and the bliss of awakening. So here you have these words, the bliss of renunciation, all of this, and these are words that basically refer to samadhi, the jhanas in particular. So this is what this is referring to. So if you really want to go deep in your meditation practice, the only way you're going to be able to do that is, first of all, to withdraw a little bit from society and company, physically first of all, and then afterwards mentally comes the withdrawal mentally as well. And when you are mentally and physically withdrawn in this way, the mind becomes secluded. The mind can let go more easily of its surroundings and the world around you. And only then have you got access to these very deep states of meditation. And this tells you a little bit about why you go on retreat, why we have noble silence. Because by going on retreat and by having noble silence, we are drawing a little bit away from the company around us. And we're kind of entering our own little world, trying to seclude ourselves from people around us. Only then is real samadhi possible, is what the Buddha is saying here. This is why, the ideal monastic way of living is in a solitude. Yeah, ideally you kind of live in the jungle somewhere far away by yourself, or at the very least you live in a good and suitable forest monasteries where you have your own kuti, because that allows you again to withdraw your mind from the company, from the attachments of the world, from all of these kind of things. As long as you delight in other people, in socializing and etc., at that point it is impossible to also enjoy seclusion in the right way. So important point, yeah. And now you know. If you had any doubts before why you came to Jhana Grove, now you know why you're here. So that is the reason. And it's very beautiful the way it is explained here. Yeah, the idea of attaining at will without trouble and difficulty. This is a standard way in the suttas, that as you practice this path, it becomes easier to achieve these things. Yeah, until the point comes, if you are really secluded, where you can attain these things without trouble and difficulty. You may wonder how that's possible, but it is possible. This is kind of the point here. And then it is very nicely, it's called the bliss of renunciation. Yeah, the happiness that comes from renouncing, especially the happiness through the five senses. And of course, the point is that the bliss of renunciation is far superior to any bliss or any happiness you can receive through the five senses. That's the whole point here. The bliss of seclusion, yeah? Seclusion is preferable to company. It is far more happy. The bliss of peace, the upasamasukha. And then the final one, which is very powerful, the bliss of awakening itself. In other words, the jhanas are almost there on the same kind of level as the awakening experience in terms of the sort of happiness and bliss you can get from this. Indeed, Ananda, it is not possible that one who delights in company, takes delight in company, devotes themselves to delight in company, who delights in society, takes delight in society, and rejoices in society, will ever enter upon and abide in either the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. But it can be expected that when you live alone, withdrawn from society, you will enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. So what this means is simply that the deliverance of mind that is temporary, and delectable, this is the samadhi experience. It is temporary. It only lasts for a while. The mind is delivered. Deliverance here means freed, liberated from what? Liberated from the defilements, liberated from the five senses. But it's temporary. You come out of it again afterwards. And this is the problem with samadhi. It's not a permanent state. And then you have the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. And this is the deliverance that comes when that samadhi matures into insight. When you see things according to reality, and then you get the unshakable deliverance of mind, whereby the defilements never happen again. So remember that both insight, true wisdom, and true samadhi are impossible without this idea of seclusion. Some degree of seclusion is always required. Yeah, at the very least, you have to mentally withdraw from the world around you. This tells you a lot about the Buddhist path, that these things are required. Okay, then there's one very last sentence at the bottom there. Not sure what that sentence is doing there. It doesn't really fit with the rest of the topic. So forget about that last sentence. It doesn't really matter. If you wish to talk about it, we can ask a question about it. It's not really so important at this particular point. Okay, so there you are. That's quite a bit of material for you this morning, so I hope I haven't gone too fast. If I have gone a bit too fast, then please, if you will, please ask some questions again about it this evening, and we can clarify perhaps any outstanding issues. So that is all for now, and we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock. Yeah.